Tonight we're going to talk about fulfilling psychological needs. I think that Western culture or Western psychology has a kind of prejudice against psychological needs. Let's imagine that a person is studying for an exam and he gets a headache, a really crashing headache, and he has an aspirin. So he has to go to the pharmacy to get aspirin. He has to. He goes to the pharmacy and sits in Israel, there's a line, you know, people are cutting your head in line. By the time he gets the aspirin, goes home and takes the aspirin, starts to take effect, he's lost an hour. How does he feel about the lost hour? Does he feel guilty? I gave in. I was weak. I don't think so. A headache's a headache. Now let's imagine a person studying for an exam and he's just crashingly bored. How much medieval French poetry can you take? And he knows that an hour's turn in the park would revive his flagging spirits and his interest in the subject, that's possible. And he takes a turn in the park. I think he's much more apt to feel guilty. So it was boring. So what? Get a grip on yourself. The race is not to the weak and lazy, because boredom's just a psychological need. Whereas a headache, that's pretty serious. That's a physical need. Imagine, by contrast, if you got the headache in the middle of the exam, would you take an hour off the exam time to get the aspirin? Probably not. You just tough it out, because in 3 hours, the exam is over. So the headache's not something that's impossible to work with. But we are much more forgiving of ourselves when it's a physical need than when it's a psychological need. Another example, a person's in his house, falls, has a crashing pain in his ankle, finds that his ankle won't support his weight. It might be broken. He needs to have an x-ray. Who would he call to ask to drive him to the hospital for an x-ray? I think there would be quite a wide range of people whom he would feel comfortable to call upon. Now imagine the same person discovers that his brother has been kidnapped by Al-Qaeda. And they're holding him for ransom. And he's distraught. He's psychologically distraught. And he just doesn't want to be alone. Would he call the same range of people just to come and be with him? As he would to be taken to the hospital for an x-ray? Or would it be a smaller group of people? Would he expect it would be harder for the other person to understand? I think we have a prejudice against our psychological needs just on the grounds of the psychological. We tend to take them less seriously, and we expect others to take them less seriously. Now, it is interesting that you cannot find this prejudice in any Jewish sources. In Jewish sources, a need is measured by its intensity. What will happen if you deny the need? What will be the damage if you deny the need? But whether the need falls into the physical category or falls into the psychological category plays no role whatsoever in assessing what should be done on the basis for the sake of that need. Let me give you some examples. The Gemara Ksuba says, when you give charity, on the one hand, you must take care of a person's needs. On the other hand, you are not obligated to enrich the person, just his needs. Then the Gemara says, that may include purchasing a horse for this person and hiring a servant that should accompany him and go before him to announce his presence. A horse and a servant. And indeed, the Gemara says that once Hillel had responsibility for some poor person in his town, couldn't find a servant who was willing to be hired for that purpose. So he, Hillel, played the role of that servant. Now, if we are told that you are not, it's not part of charity to enrich the person, purchasing a horse and providing a servant does sound like above and beyond basic needs. And the Gemara explains that we are talking here about a person who grew up in wealth and now has lost it. And because he has lost it, he has no self-confidence, he has no optimism, he has no joie de vivre. Ugh, there I am quoting the French. I should strike that from my vocabulary. He has no joy in life. He's depressed. And for that sake, you could spend charity money to purchase him a horse and hire a servant. Because tending to his psychological needs is as much a part of charity as tending to his physical needs. And again, the category, whether psychological or physical, makes no difference whatsoever. It's rather a matter of the severity of the need. There are people who are starving. If they don't get food, they're going to die. There are people who are suicidal. If they don't get psychological help, they're going to die. So, from our point of view, makes the difference that one is physical and the other psychological. Denying them both puts them in danger of dying, then they get equal treatment. And so it is across the board. Ah, you'll tell me, but this guy grew up in luxury. His problem now is that he can't adjust to normal circumstances. Should we use charity money to feed his addiction to luxury? And the answer is that you break a person from an addiction gradually. You gradually reduce the addicted materials. If you don't, you're in danger of really breaking the person, really injuring the person. And so in the meantime, you will indeed use charity money to purchase for him what would be for others luxurious items, but for him are psychological necessities. The Gemara Shabbos considers the appropriateness of an operation to remove a blemish from the face. Okay, I don't want to go into this part of it. It's considered appropriate for women, not appropriate for men. Men shouldn't be that concerned about their appearance. I'm just saying that so I don't be misunderstood. What I'm interested in is this. The Gemara says, if the blemish on the face causes a person pain, then he certainly can have the operation. Tosfos asks, when the Gemara says pain, pain justifies the operation, would the Gemara include embarrassment? The pain that the person feels is that he's embarrassed. When the Gemara says pain, does it include psychological pain? And Tosfos says, of course it does. Pain is pain. When the Gemara says pain, psychological pain is just a natural part of that category. The Rambam, in his introduction to Pirkei Avos, which is 8 chapters long, in the 5th chapter, he discusses the principle of letting all your actions be for the sake of heaven. How would such a person eat, says Rambam? He would eat foods that would contribute to his health and to his strength, not foods that his palate enjoyed necessarily. Then the Rambam says, what happens if a person loses interest in food to the point that he's not getting adequate nutrition? For such a person, says the Rambam, we should hire gourmet chefs to prepare the most attractive, tantalizing foods so as to induce him to eat enough to provide himself with adequate nutrition. This is not anorexia, as you can tell from the description of the solution. Then the Rambam goes on to say, there are certain types of depression that are brought on by aesthetic deprivation. A person who is surrounded by a drab and ugly environment, such a person is in danger of depression. And therefore, money should be spent to provide him with a steady diet of beauty so as to protect his psychological health. Now, the Rambam here puts the two points in juxtaposition. Food for nutrition and aesthetics to avoid depression. Putting them back to back means he sees them as instances of the same general principle, caring for your needs. And then the Rambam goes on to say, a person, all of whose actions are for the sake of heaven, is not going to sew golden threads into his clothes, nor paint golden murals on the walls. And the reader says, of course not. That's just a total waste. And then the Rambam says, unless... And the reader says, unless... I mean, there might be times when, for the sake of heaven, a person would sew golden threads into his clothes and paint golden murals on the walls. And the Rambam says, yes. If a person is in danger of depression, and this is what is necessary to support the psychological health, then it would be appropriate to sew golden threads into your clothes and paint golden murals on the walls. Which shows you again that this is taken with absolute seriousness. The idea that investment in your psychological needs is just as valid and as appropriate as investment in your physical needs. These sources prove that it's true, and for those who have a little experience, you will notice I didn't use any Hasidic sources, because people have a certain prejudice against Hasidic sources. They think they're sort of soft. So I use the Gemara, I use the Rishonim. Nothing from the Hasidic movement. These sources prove that it's true, but they don't explain why it's true. For those who have a mind for logic, that's an important distinction you should think about in general, the difference between proving and explaining. There is a source that does explain why. And this is an essay by one of the Tells of Rosh Hashivas in a collection called Shirei Das. This particular essay is called Palis Magar Raglecho, which means roughly draw a line around your feet, draw a circle around your feet. And here's what the author says. In the Talmud it states that a person, a man, who stops learning Torah for no valid purpose is as if he worshipped idols. A man who stops learning Torah unnecessarily is as if he worshipped idols. And the author spends 5 pages proving that this statement was meant literally, it wasn't meant just as a hyperbole or poetry. But then the author addresses the main question. One word in that statement desperately needs a definition. Which word? Unnecessarily. He stops learning Torah unnecessarily, as if he worships an idol. What counts as an unnecessary cessation of Torah study? What would count as a necessary cessation of Torah study? Where's the line? How do you draw the line? The author says to the reader, you will tell me that the boundary line should be drawn biologically. Do I have to stop studying Torah to sleep? Yes, because otherwise I won't be able to study Torah. Do I have to stop studying Torah to eat? Yes, because otherwise I won't be able to study Torah. Do I have to stop studying Torah to work? Yes, if I am cursed by being less than independently wealthy, and therefore I won't be able to eat or sleep unless I work, so I'm going to have to go to work. But you, the reader, will tell me that I stop studying Torah only when my biology forces me to. Says the author, that's wrong. That's wrong. Capital W. That's not the correct criterion. The correct criterion, says the author, is this. Every person should feel positive, confident, optimistic,
happy, satisfied, joyful, upbeat, proactive, jargon. All those lovely things. Everybody should have an ideal emotional state. And anything you need to do to promote that emotional state is called necessary cessation of Torah study. Necessary. What would you need to do, asks the author, to feel happy, optimistic, strong, self-confidence, positive, etc. Says the author, one needs aesthetics, like the Rambam said, and relaxation, normal, relaxed conversation, not just what did you learn in the shiur today, what new Muslim insight did you have today, but how do you feel, whether you're from home, you know, and other such relaxed items. Aesthetics, relaxation, conversation, contact with people, and physical pleasure. Some measure of each of them is necessary to feel happy, optimistic, joyful, positive, confident, optimistic, strong, and therefore stopping Torah study in order to engage in those activities so as to promote that emotional state is necessary cessation of Torah study. And therefore, it's fully justified. Now, the author says, what have I done? I have expanded the boundary of acceptable indulgences. You might have thought that it's never appropriate to play tennis. But if you are anxious about something, nervous, if your relationship with your chavrus is going from bad to worse, if you're irritable and nasty and sarcastic, and people are getting fed up with you, and you know that by playing a few sets of tennis, especially if you win, then you'll feel much more relaxed and happy with yourself, and you'll be much easier and much more accepting of other people, and that will improve your relationships and improve your learning, then it's appropriate to go and play tennis. So I have expanded, says the author, the circle of acceptable indulgences. But still, there are limits. Maybe it might be appropriate to go and watch a baseball game. But 5 days of cricket is ridiculous. That's absurd. Only the lazy British, you know, and the poor empire can put up with that. They're ahead by 270 runs. Thanks a lot.
26 hours to go.
Yeah, what can a run be worth if you're ahead by 270 runs? Anyway, there's a limit. Now, says the author, you will ask me, how should I draw the limit? The limit between acceptable indulgences on the one hand and really gross luxury on the other hand. Of course, the definition of the limit is don't take something unless you need it to contribute to that ideal emotional state that you're trying to build up. But the author imagines a case like this. Here I am, it's June 23rd, 5:30 in the afternoon. I'm sitting in the Ursa Merch Beis Medrash. This is 8 years ago, without air conditioning. It's hot and dry.
Perfect.
Really? Okay. And I'm studying the Mishnah. And here we go. Shnayim rochasim b'talis, two people are holding on to a talis. Zeh mar kula shali, this one says it's all mine. Zeh mar kula shali, this one says Coca-Cola. What does it say? What? No, that's not what it says. No, let's go on. This is how many, Mr. CEO. This one says I found it. This is how many, Mr. CEO. This one says Coca-Cola. Well, I'm thirsty, you know. So the keeper, Coca-Cola keeps, you know, jumping in. Now, should I get a Coke? Shouldn't I get a Coke? just a moment now. You know, there are unacceptable luxuries. One has to be careful about this. Is the Coke justified or isn't the Coke justified? I'm a careful person. I'm a serious person. So I've been keeping records. How many days has it been since the last Coke? What was the mean temperature, mean humidity since the last Coke? How many other drinks have I had since the last Coke? How many average hours have I had? You know, I've been keeping record for 18 months. Coke, yes, Coke, no, results, consequence, that whole chart. You know, the mean and the distribution and the records of error and the delta functions. I've got the whole thing planned out. Because service of God is serious, you know. Now, as I'm calculating this Coke, to have it or not, how do I feel, asks the boss. I guess I feel nervous, kind of worried, self-doubting, anxious. So look at my situation now. In order to figure out whether I need the Coke to feel happy, optimistic, strong, confident, I feel nervous, upset, anxious, worried, self-doubting. This is a self-defeating exercise. Said the author, under those conditions, don't calculate. Just take it. Don't calculate. Don't analyze. Just take it. When would you say no? Only when it's obvious or easy to discover that it's too much. Or it doesn't cost. Or it doesn't hurt you. But if the investigation is going to make you worried, don't even do the investigation. Just take it. So I think you see that this is being taken very seriously as an important principle. Now why? And here's what the author of this essay says. He says, because God wants of us not only quantity of service, but quality of service. And the quality of your service depends on feeling happy, self-confident, optimistic, strong, hopeful. You should walk, as he says, with mitzvei oz, with steps of strength. You should manifest tiferes ha'adam, the glory of man. That's the kind of person you should be, that you represent yourself as. The quality of the service of God depends upon that emotional state. And God wants high quality service in addition to quantity of service. So let's see. Part of my service of God is in my interpersonal relations. The Mishnah says, how is it? Kabbalists call Adam to save upon the Yopos. Greet each person with a pleasant expression and with a calm and sensitive interaction. Now, if I'm nervous, upset, worried, anxious, self-doubting, depressed, I can't do that. So that area of mitzvos is just not going to be performed, but not be performed in the best possible way. Prayer, I'm supposed to focus on God. If I'm really worried, I'm likely to be distracted by my worries and not focus on God. Shabbos is supposed to be a time of joy. That's part of the meaning of Shabbos. A person who's worried, anxious, depressed, is not going to be able to celebrate Shabbos in the appropriate way, nor with the holidays. Every mitzvah is supposed to be done with joy. If there was Hashem b'simcha, serve God with joy. If the person is in that negative emotional condition, he's not going to be able to do that. So this is the reason. It's not because there's a mitzvah to be happy. That's a mistake. It is because in order to do all the other mitzvahs the way they should be done, a person needs to be happy. And therefore, the need to be happy is a means, not an end, but a means is very important. You know, breathing is also a means. It doesn't mean it's less important. My Rebbe illustrated this with a famous statement from the Talmud. He gave it a beautiful explanation. When Joseph is in Egypt, Jacob thinks he's dead and mourns for him for more than 20 years, finally, Joseph sends a message to his father that he's alive. Jacob is on his way down to Egypt. Joseph comes to meet him. When they meet, the Torah says that they embraced, and Joseph wept on his father's neck. If you read through the Tanakh, you find that weeping is very common. Men weeping is very common. We are terribly inhibited. That men
don't feel comfortable weeping in public, and I think it's psychologically injurious. Anyway, it says that Joseph wept on his father's neck. It doesn't say anything about Jacob's reaction. The Torah is totally silent. So the Talmud asks, what was Jacob doing? And it answers, he was saying the Shema. That's what Jacob was doing, saying the Shema. Now, we should ask, saying the Shema? He hasn't seen his son in 22 years. He heard some short time ago that his son is still alive. He's now going to embrace his son after 22 years. He's saying the Shema? Okay, you'll tell me, but it was time to say the Shema. How long does it take to say Shema? 3 minutes? Okay, it's Jacob. 20 minutes. Still, there are 3 hours in the morning when you can say it. I didn't have to say it in these 20 minutes. Obviously, Jacob chose these 20 minutes to say the Shema. Why did he do that? Now, here's my everybody's explanation. When a person says Shema, he's pledging allegiance to God. He's accepting upon himself the yoke of the heaven, the yoke of heaven upon himself, the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. Now, that means he offers himself to God. How much does he offer? All of himself. How much is that? How much is all of himself? It depends upon how much he is. The more he is, the bigger the offer. Now, during those 20 years, when Jacob was mourning for Joseph, he did not have prophecy. He did not have prophecy because in order to have prophecy, you have to be in a state of joy. And he couldn't manage it. During those 20 years, he said the Shema. And each time he said the Shema, he offered all of himself to God. But there was less of him to offer. And therefore, the Shema was a lesser Shema. Now, he hears that Joseph is alive, and he anticipates embracing him, and he anticipates that surge of joy, and he says, I will have an opportunity to say a Shema that I haven't said in 20 years, because I will be more. And since I will be more, the Shema will be more. And that's what he wants to do with that moment. He wants to take those new, recovered powers and use them to say Shema that he hasn't said. This is an illustration of the idea that the quality of the mitzvah that you do depends upon this psychological state, and therefore this building the psychological state is a responsibility. It's a responsibility for the sake of doing that mitzvah in a better way. I'm aware of certain examples of contemporary great people. I'm not at liberty to use their names because I didn't hear it from them, I heard it from those who knew them. But I'm talking about the top of the line, really top of the line. I have an acquaintance, an American fellow, who was at the beach in Tel Aviv, the religious beach, the separated beach. And he saw an old gentleman sitting in a beach chair, a gentleman with a long white beard, just sitting there in a beach chair. He never went into the water. No children or grandchildren around him. Just sitting there in the beach chair, watching the ocean. So, this fellow is an American and hasn't got any manners or any sense. And he walks over to the older gentleman and says to him, what are you doing here? I see you just sitting on the chair doing, you know, like doing nothing. You know, what are you doing here? So he said, the gentleman on the chair said, I'm a posek. Posek means a religious decisor. Someone who answers difficult religious queries. And I'm telling you, he's really, you know, his name's up there in lights. And he said, when you answer practical religious queries, you have to pay very careful attention to details. Little details often make the difference. And so you are making very fine distinctions and going after all of the little details of each case. Periodically, he said, I come to the sea. Because observing the sea restores a sense of the grandeur, the greatness, the largeness of things, and that helps me achieve a kind of psychological balance. Now, here's a person who appreciates the aesthetics of the ocean. Anybody who's been to the ocean knows how impressive it is. He appreciates the aesthetics of the ocean and realizes that it can have a salutary psychological effect and chooses it for that purpose so that he'll be able to serve God with greater psychological balance. There is a Rosh Hashiva where I was told regularly listens to Mozart because he finds that Mozart creates in a certain mood, a mood that he feels is valuable and is serving God, and therefore he listens to Mozart. There is a letter of the Chazon Ish in his collected letters. It's letter number 35. Unfortunately, they're not translated into English. Now, from the letter, which is an answer to a student, we can more or less figure out what the student's letter in question was. The student must have written something like this. I'm exhausted. It's coming to the end of one of the trimesters of the Jewish academic year, and I'm exhausted, physically, psychologically, worn out. And I know that according to our academic year, there's a vacation coming up. But where does it say in the Code of Jewish Law that you're supposed to take vacations? Which entry in the Shulchan Aruch talks about vacations, when to take them, how to take them, where to take them, how long they should be? I'm not aware of any such element in the Shulchan Aruch. So this student wrote, I feel guilty in taking a vacation. On the other hand, I'm exhausted. What should I do? So the Chazon Ish writes back, no, my dear one, he writes, no. That there is no sin and no guilt in resting when one is exhausted. After all, he says, why did you get exhausted? Because it is part of nature that when you exert yourself, you get tired. And nature, he says, is just another word for the repetitive, constant aspect of God's providence. Which means that you are tired because God wanted you to get tired. Just as God organizes the rising and falling, the setting of the sun, and the falling of the rain, and the growth of the plants, when a human being gets tired, it's because God wants him to be tired. And he says it's not appropriate to despise nature, to show contempt for nature, because nature is an aspect of God's will. And therefore, he says, you are obligated to take 2 weeks of vacation. Sleep well, he says. Eat well. Go on tiyulim. Been long enough to know what a tiyul is. A trip. Vacation trip. And he says, l'harbos inyone batola. To multiply matters of batola. Now, you know, people live in yeshivas are very careful about their speech. The closest thing that a yeshiva person knows to a swear word is batala. Batala means doing nothing. Wasting time. The Jewish definition of wasting time is temporary suicide. Because if you're wasting time, you're dead. When the Chazon Ish says to this yeshiva student, I was inani batala, it's like slapping him in the face. There's no stronger word that the Chazon Ish could have used to shake this person up. Then the Chazon Ish writes, you wrote me interesting Torah thoughts in your letter, I'm not answering them. Understand why? Because if the Chazon Ish will answer them, then the student will go to answer the answers and he'll be tied up in the same syndrome again. No, I'm not answering them. And then he says, if you have trouble with this prescription, come here and I'll make sure you keep it. So here you have, coming from one of the greatest people in the 20th century, he says, you're obligated to stop learning entirely for 2 weeks. Stop learning entirely. And then he says, happy are you that exhausted yourself in the study of Torah. Now, many people exhaust themselves in narshkeit, in foolishness. You exhausted yourself in the study of Torah. Happy are you that you did it that way. Now, I'll mention an application of this, which probably doesn't apply to any of you directly, but it may apply to those you know. And here it's extremely important. There are people who have constant care for others. Families who are caring for elderly parents,
or who, God forbid, have sick family members, and are giving care to people who need it. The patient desperately needs the care. The caregiver often is simply exhausted. He has his own responsibilities, other responsibilities, has this responsibility, he's working around the clock and he's exhausted. But to take time off creates a terrible sense of guilt, because the needy one is so needy. How can I allow myself? I am healthy, thank God. I am functional, thank God. How can I allow myself to neglect, even for an hour, this person who is so needy? Sometimes this is short-sighted, because by not taking the hour off, the caregiver automatically reduces the quality of the care. He can't be as sensitive, he can't be as giving, he can't be as attentive, because he can't handle it. And by taking off the hour, he will increase the quality and the ultimate impact of the care. We have friends in South Africa, one of their children severed a finger. They drove to the hospital, and they had, at that time, before things went from bad to worse, they had a very fine medical establishment, and they had three microsurgeons working on sewing his finger back on, reattaching the nerves, reattaching the blood vessels. The surgery took hours. Now, they're working there under microscopes, making these very, very fine motions. Every half hour, they stopped doing the surgery and just walked around the room, stretched their fingers, stretched their muscles, and so on and so on. But what do you mean? This poor kid is there with his fingers still severed, you know, severed. It's not reattached. And you're walking around the room. Yeah, but if I don't walk around the room, I won't be able to do the surgery. I just can't do this kind of micro adjustment continuously without rest in between. So you have to measure realistically what your psychological needs are, so as to get, on the whole, the best possible performance. This means the investment of money and the use of expertise for the sake of one's psychological needs, just as one would with physical needs, as we said at the beginning. And here I want to alert you to another symptom of the same prejudice that we started with. Let's say a person, God forbid, has a broken leg. Broken leg, goes to the hospital and gets a cast, and x-rays, and therapy, crutches, wheelchair. Let's suppose a person has a phobia. A phobia for authority. People exercise authority over him, and it frightens him, and he can't face it. And therefore it's hard for him to hold a job. It's hard for him to be in such types of relationships. So we say to him, why don't you get help? He says, let me get help. Do you think I have a problem? That would mean I have a problem. Now that word is very interesting. That word only comes up when it's a psychological matter. No one defines a broken leg as a problem. He can't walk. That's not a problem. It's not a problem. Just a broken leg. And we'll take care of that, you know. But a phobia? Oh, that would be a problem. And he doesn't want to admit that he has a problem. Why? Why? One is dysfunctional. The other is dysfunctional. One has a treatment. The other may very well have a treatment. And if it has a treatment, why not make use of it and improve your life? Because it's psychological, and therefore the whole picture becomes clouded with our fears and our prejudices, when in fact it simply should not be so. Many years ago, a fellow came to me. He's a Valtura, and he was learning in a kugel someplace. And he was married about 5 years. I think they had two or three children. And he saved up enough money to buy himself a copy of the Talmud. I see when religious people get married, the wife's parents buy the husband a copy of the Talmud. That's a regular rule. But of course, here, neither set of parents was religious, so they're making it by scratch. And he's been investing years in learning, and he finally has enough money to buy himself his first copy of the Talmud. That's a great, joyous event. I remember it. And he says to me, my wife wants to use the money to repaint the apartment. How can I convince her that, you know, buying the dollar is more important than repainting the apartment? So I said to him, imagine your wife told you that she's having migraine headaches. And the only solution is a medicine that comes from Switzerland, and it will take the money that you saved it. What would you say? So he said, migraine headaches? Of course. That's terrible. Of course you have to have medicine for that. So I said to him, your wife is telling you that that unpainted apartment is depressing. And she's there making that home for you and for your children. Why aren't you as worried with her feelings of depression as you would be with her headaches? Similarly, a woman came to me and said, we're married, we have three children, we live in a walk-up, third story from the street. And when I go to the Makolet with my three children and have to go grocery shopping, and I have to, it was before that everybody used to deliver, today paying 5 shekels, they deliver it to the door, but it didn't used to be that way. And I come home with the three kids, with the stroller, and with all the packages, it's exhausting. Shall I call my husband home from learning? It's like twice a week in the afternoon, to help me with the shopping. So I said to her, it depends upon what the consequences of doing it on your own are. If you tell me, every night when I get to bed to go to sleep, I read three chapters of my favorite novel. But on the right night that I go shopping, I'm so tired I can only read two chapters. I think, under those conditions, it wouldn't be appropriate to call your husband home. I'm learning. But if you tell me, when I finish schlepping it all upstairs, I'm so tired that I'm irritable to my children, that I can't really invest myself in davening mincha, and I find myself feeling resentful, then yes, indeed, call your husband home. I'll let him help you with the shopping. It all depends upon the consequences of ignoring the need. And in this case, whether they're psychological or physical, makes absolutely no difference. Is everybody with me so far? Now, one fly in the ointment and the reconciliation will be finished. I've been saying so far to service the psychological needs. But don't we grow? Don't we develop? Should I look forward to always having the same needs? Won't satisfying them reinforce them and maintain them? Shouldn't I try to develop myself to the point where I don't have the same psychological needs and where I'll be able to do with less? The answer is yes. There is a responsibility to develop. There is a responsibility to try to lessen one's psychological needs. To a certain extent, this happens naturally with maturity and with greater focus. But there is a responsibility to do so. The crucial thing is how to do it. And this how to do it applies to all progress, all personal progress, and very particular, it applies to religious personal progress. Here's where I am. I want to grow in that direction. Now, how do I take my steps forward? The answer is, I only take a step if I'm very confident that the step will not disturb my ability to continue functioning. If there is any substantial probability, any substantial danger, that taking this step may threaten my ability to continue functioning, I don't take it. The comparison here is one that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, is sports. I'm doing the pole vault, and I'm currently jumping 12 feet. I want to qualify for the Olympics, which is an 18-foot jump. That's all right, I'm only 13 years old, so I have time. Now, I asked my trainer, should I put the bar up another 2 inches or not? And the pole vault goes up by 2 inches. What does a trainer's attitude going to be? If I'm going to risk injuring myself, he's not going to put it up. Because if I injure myself, I'm going to lose weeks or months of training. It's just not worth it. So he's only going to put the bar up when he's quite confident that I will not injure myself and thereby risk my ability to continue training. Here too, if I'm considering taking a step, depriving myself of something to see what I can do without it and thereby make my performance more efficient, I must be very confident that it's not going to interrupt my ability to continue functioning. Because if it does, then my overall progress is going to be much more break and retarded. When I first came here 22 years ago, there was a fellow here who told me that he had a terrible, terrible addiction, one which really bothered him. Every week he had to read Sports Illustrated. This for him was, without question, definitely part of it. But he had gotten into Gemara learning, and he said, I really regret the time I lost from learning Gemara. But on the other hand, I really want to read Sports Illustrated. What should I do? So I said to him, how many hours does it take you to read the Sports Illustrated? He said, 2 hours. I said to him, if you don't read it, how many hours a week are you going to worry about it? Is it going to bother you? He said, probably bother me an hour a day. I'm going to be upset about it. So I said to him, read it. You're 5 hours a week ahead. Now, as it happened, 4 or 5 months later, he gave up his subscription. He outgrew it. I felt that in the meantime, it wasn't worth fighting the battle, and that he would naturally lose his interest in it. I mean, how many times can you look at the same statistics? Oh, it's off by 5 percentage points. Great. You know, something to write home about. Call your friends. Send straight emails. Right? Such nourishment. It's travesty. But why fight the battle when it's going to be a struggle and you're going to feel it out of yourself and worried about it when in a few months it'll drop off by itself? Same thing is true with any step of progress. A person is contemplating a new mitzvah. Am I ready? Am I strong enough to take on this new mitzvah? So, in terms of tonight's subject, the first question you have to ask yourself is, what will be the sum total consequences, including the psychological consequences and emotional consequences of taking on this new mitzvah? And this can be very subtle. If I take on a mitzvah, which typically in my circle is not done, is this going to stimulate my pride? If it stimulates my pride, is it worth it? Is it worth doing this new mitzvah? And it's going to injure my personality, which is also a mitzvah? It's one mitzvah against another mitzvah. And both mitzvahs have to be taken seriously. But especially if taking the step forward is going to put me under such strain that I'm going to suffer losses in other areas. And it's fairly likely that at a certain point down the line, I'm going to come to the conclusion that the step was a mistake. And I really can't handle it. And then I'll have to reverse it. And then I will come to question my judgment. So I guess I don't really understand what I'm capable of, what I'm not capable of. And then a person in a down frame of mind can push it further. Maybe the whole thing isn't right for me. Maybe the whole decision to get involved in the first place wasn't right. He comes to question his involvement altogether, possibilities for his future. It's a downward spiral from taking an overambitious step at the outset. The solution is to take small steps. Those take small steps. And this is the last point I want to leave you with, although these words are distinct, which we'll do on another occasion. Every mitzvah can be subdivided. Mitzvahs are not package deals. Every mitzvah can be subdivided. So that if the mitzvah as a whole is too daunting, just too much to handle, divide it. About 10 years ago, we had a fellow here from Michigan State University for a summer program, 6 weeks. At the end, he said to me, Shabbos was wonderful. I'd never experienced anything like that before in my life. And I would like to incorporate Shabbos into my life. But I have a problem. I'm at Michigan State University. And the number one priority at Michigan State is?
Football.
Football. You're not part of that world. At Michigan State, number one is football, number two is football, number three is football, number four is parties, and then, studies are about 10 or 11. Right? And he said, football games are Saturday afternoon, and don't talk to me about football. Football, that's given. But on the other hand, Shabbos was very impressive and very moving, and I liked it for a minute. So what should I do? That's what rabbis are for, right? Shabbos versus football, what should we do? So I said to him, keep Friday night. So far, as I know, there are no football games on Friday night. That's one time they haven't invaded yet. Now, listen to me, boys and girls. This is very important, what I'm going to tell you now. Neither he nor I was fooled. There is only one Shabbos, and it's 25 hours long. Don't give me this baloney. If only God had known about football, he wouldn't have made it for Saturday afternoons. He would have made it for Friday afternoons. You know, poor God couldn't see the future. Leave that to the other movements who, you know better than God, better than Moses. Shabbos is 25 hours, period. We're not reforming Shabbos. But if you can't keep the whole of Shabbos, keep part of it. Keep as much as you can. We're not changing Shabbos, but we're recognizing that a person may have limitations. Can't keep Shabbos every week, keep it every other week, keep it once a month. Do what you can. But David, you pick up that sitter, that awesome, frightening, you know, devastating book filled with all that black print. God, say all that. Just the morning prayer is taking about 8 hours. So don't say it all. Skip 80% to 90% of it. Indeed, do it the other way. Ask yourself, how many minutes of this can you tolerate? Six? We'll show you what the most important 6 minutes are. Nine? We'll add 3 minutes for you. Two? I'll give you something to say for 2 minutes. Every mitzvah can be subdivided. There's nothing wrong with subdividing it. It's assumed that a person will have to take the gradual steps. Steps, as I said, where a person is confident that he can take the step without destroying his equilibrium, without his ability to continue to function. And then you take it step by step. Don't despise small steps. Don't despise small steps. This is the strategy of the Yetzer Hara, of the evil inclination, of the sun, to say to you, you're going to keep one Shabbos out of four? That's not worthy of you. You're not a child. You're a strong person, a courageous person. One out of four, that's too degrading for you. Wait until you have the strength to do it 100%. That appeals to your dignity. It appeals to your honor. And it shovels you into the grave. Because he knows very well that you're never going to have the strength to do it all at once. And that's his way of putting you off. Wait until. The minute the voice inside says, wait, that's when the alarm bells you go. Why should I wait? Why should I wait? Why should I do it now? But what? Do it to the extent that you can do it now. Kashrus, how many times have I been told, Rabbi, I can certainly keep kosher at home. But at university, socially, at work, I just can't handle it. It's too embarrassing. I'm not going to be able to do it. And, the person says, I'm not the kind of person to keep kosher at home and eat treif outside. That's hypocritical. It's not honest. So I'm waiting for that time when I will have the strength to cut a clean break and keep 100% kosher. That's terrible. And what makes it terrible is that only idealistic people, only serious people get caught in this trap. A person who's not serious or idealistic says, I do it, I don't do it with innocent. No, this is a person with ideals who wants to be honest with himself, but he's making a terrible mistake. The correct attitude is, do what you can. You can keep kosher at home, keep kosher at home. It's too hard for you right now to keep kosher outside, then don't keep kosher outside. Be realistic about your limitations and do what you can. Indeed, a person who becomes kosher at home means 60% of his meals are kosher. Gradually he will find that his attachment to kashrus becomes greater and greater, and that in itself reinforces the motivation ultimately to be able to make the break in public and to keep kosher in public. If he doesn't keep kosher at home, he may never develop that psychological strength. I'll end with one illustration that everyone who has become a Baal Teshuva I think has used. I've used it as well. You're standing in Grand Central Station. For those who don't know New York, Grand Central Station is a big train station. They hold 100,000 people.
3 blocks.
3 blocks. It's gigantic. Now, you look at your watch, and it's 6:23. Sundown is 6:30, and you have not davened mincha, you have not said the afternoon prayers. Uh-huh. What to do now? Walk over to the wall and start, you know, weaving about it? Looks a little peculiar. Of course, in Grand Central Station, probably won't attract much attention because there's everything there. You know, no matter how peculiar it is, it's there somewhere. But still, if you are a dignified person, You just feel kind of funny doing that. Now, there is a solution to this problem. A solution that, as I said, everyone I know has used. Go to the telephone booth, you put it in a quarter, you make a long distance call. I swear you're going to say, oh, the other one is everyone I know has done this. Because you just don't have the courage to stand up there against the wall. They knock on the booth and anyway, now look, imagine you're standing at Grand Central Station and somebody comes over to you and he says, look, here's a check for $10 million. I'm going to write your name in it. Just walk over to the wall and we can talk for 10 minutes. What would you do? I don't know about you, but I'd be there like that. It wouldn't take me a second. We would think probably if somebody said, you nut, what are you doing? Yes, I'm earning $10 million. But you have to be, would you like to be standing here? Every mitzvah that you do is worth more than $10 million. It has an infinite payback. So really, I shouldn't have any embarrassment whatsoever. Davening mincha in public. But it is normal to be embarrassed. And indeed, years ago when I started out, I was embarrassed too. Today I have no embarrassment whatsoever. Attention, I can put on my talus and fill it in the airport, on the airplane, in the train station. No, I was absolutely innocent. But it wasn't always that way. And it is appropriate then to use the telephone booth solution until you too gather the psychological courage to be able to stand up and do it without that. Take your limitations seriously. Work gradually to overcome them and extend your abilities. Make sure that when you take your steps, it don't threaten your ability to continue to function. And in that way, you will grow to reduce your psychological needs while you are servicing them to the extent is necessary to be happy, strong, optimistic, hopeful, and confident. Questions? Thank you.